From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Destroyer is a thriller set in Los Angeles. It's about an undercover cop played by Nicole Kidman, who's been scarred by her work. Director Karin Kusama says she's happy to flip the usual gender role.
You know, the idea that, like, a woman investigating a crime and realizing that in the larger meta story, she's actually investigating herself, that shouldn't be a story that only belongs to men.
And part of Les Moonves' bonus will be used to prevent sexual assaults and harassment. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures' Crazy Rich Asians. National Board of Review winner for Best Ensemble, Crazy Rich Asians has moved audiences and critics alike. Now nominated for 2 Golden Globes. For your consideration in all categories, including Best Picture.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll start today with Destroyer. The movie stars Nicole Kidman as a cop who goes undercover with her partner, played by Sebastian Stan.
All right, kiss me.
Why?
So I know. I don't want to look surprised the first time it happens in public.
Think you can fake liking that?
The narrative of Destroyer goes back and forth in time as we see Kidman's character transform both physically and emotionally. Shot in and around Los Angeles, Destroyer falls in the genre of film noir. The other day, we drove over to the L.A. River, near where the Glendale and Golden State freeways converge, to meet Kusama. We stopped to talk at a key location in her film.
Well, the last time I was here shooting was in probably early January, because we shot that after the holiday break. And it was very cold, unusually cold, really rough to be shooting here at night and then in early in the morning. Although there were incredible seabirds to just sort of marvel at. Construction vehicles in the background.
It's a strange place, a former rail yard that's managed by California State Parks. Trains are rolling by at regular intervals, and while we were there, the river was being dredged by bulldozers.
And then I took a walk here with my husband over the summer while I was shooting on the other side of the river, just to see another perspective of it. And it's funny because there's like new fancy housing over there, and so it just felt like such a crazy collision of industrial and urban and suburban and the natural world and kind of high and low, rich and poor. Just it all meets right here at this river.
When you were thinking about how you wanted to cast the city of LA in this film, what were the conversations you had with your locations department? Because oddly enough, I think one of your location scouts worked on La La Land, which is a very, very different portrait of Los Angeles than you have in Destroyer.
In fact, our location manager and a lot of his team worked on La La Land, and he was so excited for the opportunity to do this, like, gritty version of L.A., and also a sense of seeing the L.A. that we don't see as frequently, the kind of, I don't want to say the underbelly, just the neglected parts cinematically. And so, you know, there's something, like, we looked at locations for the river that were much more pristine and, you know, Terminator and really cool, but already captured on film. And there was something about this like wild green landscape coming up against these like concrete slopes that felt, I don't know, like we hadn't seen much of that yet.
Because there's so much in your film where we typically would see beauty, we see ugliness. And it's not just in the locations, it's in your lead actor, Nicole Kidman, who is one of the most beautiful women around. And yet when we see her in most of this film, she's almost completely unrecognizable. I mean, she is damaged, I guess.
I would say hardened and weathered. And I actually think she takes on a kind of majesty with that. She certainly has a lot of power. To me, when I look at her on screen, I find her incredibly compelling in that state. And because we know what Nicole looked like before, she really challenges us. And I think there's something about seeing her in the past when she was lighter and more hopeful and kind of enthusiastic and reckless that makes the question or the mystery of those 17 years between then and now that much deeper. But yeah, beauty and chaos, beauty and ugliness in bed together are my go-to favorite recipes.
To transform Nicole, you hired, I believe, a makeup artist who had worked on Deadpool. Do I have that right?
Yes, he had worked on Deadpool, but he'd also worked on Star Wars and Lemony Snicket and Foxcatcher. And Foxcatcher actually was a really useful reference for me because he was really going for making one real person look like another real person. And that was our goal with Nicole. And Bill Corso was just the most lovely genius you could imagine to do that particular job. One thing we always, when we all sat together, Nicole, Bill, and I, we always knew was that Nicole has really, really beautiful porcelain skin, a really perfect, delicate nose, very bright, vivid eyes. And we just sort of immediately, as we were talking, were like, okay, sun damage, no sunscreen for decades and decades, freckles, liver spots, a broken nose, eye bags from exhaustion. And all of that, as it started to come together, really helped Nicole, I think, really embed herself in that character.
What is it like as a filmmaker to see an actor come on set the first day looking like she looks? Because it's no spoiler, it's the very opening shot of the film.
In some ways, there was a process to it that allowed us to all kind of acclimate ourselves to that transformation because we were doing makeup tests over the course of our prep. I think that the moment where her complete transformation really came together was when she came onto set during a camera test with the makeup on and the jacket. And that jacket, we had actually imagined that she wasn't wearing that jacket every single day of our linear story. And she said, no, I gotta wear this jacket. Like, this jacket is my armor. It's part of how I move. It's how I hide. And so it was a really interesting thing to see her sort of say, oh, no, this is Belle's jacket. Belle never takes this jacket off. And so we were like, okay, Aaron Bell doesn't take the jacket off, so neither will Nicole.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Karin Kusama on the banks of the LA River.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures and the acclaimed surprise hit of the year, Crazy Rich Asians. Director John Chu redefined the romantic comedy genre by bringing Nick and Rachel's love story to the big screen. Joe Morgenstern of the Wall Street Journal calls it a hugely enjoyable, heartfelt, and hilarious cultural milestone. National Board of Review winner for Best Ensemble, Crazy Rich Asians is now nominated for 2 Golden Globes, including Best Picture and Best Actress, for your consideration in all categories, including Best Picture.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Let's get back to my conversation with director Karin Kusama. We recorded it alongside the LA River at a location that she used in her new film, Destroyer. The movie is made in the vein of a film noir thriller. It was written by Kusama's husband, Phil Hay, and his writing partner, Matt Manfredi. There are also producers on the movie. Destroyer stars Nicole Kidman as an undercover cop who's been left damaged by a decision that she made in her past. She's also a mother of a teenage daughter. And those are two attributes that you rarely see in movies of this sort, which Kusama says is a shame.
And perhaps to those narratives' detriment, because what I'm really starting to think about isn't that the character that she's playing would typically be occupied by a male, or that it is a male role, but that there's been more of a deficit of a fuller life represented, a fuller humanity. Somehow what I'm thinking about right now is the fact that, like, in Meet the Parents, Ben Stiller is a nurse. And you're, even though that's meant to be a joke, I was always so thankful that I got to see a guy be a nurse because there are so many guys who are nurses. And so I feel like, why don't we just expand our expectations of these movies and these roles and these jobs? And, you know, the idea that like a woman investigating a crime and realizing that in the larger meta story, she's actually investigating herself, that shouldn't be a story that only belongs to men. I mean, it absolutely isn't. We know this. So it's important to give these kinds of stories a little more breadth and see women, interesting women in interesting stories.
It's easy to describe Destroyer as a dark movie, and it certainly has a lot of dark aspects to it. But ultimately, it seems to me that it is a movie about what it takes to be good. Did you always think about it in that way?
I totally love that definition of it, and I actually haven't heard that before, and I love hearing it because I completely agree with you that we are watching a character who has told herself and has been told by the outside world that she is not good, and yet there's some kernel in her that resists that, and in resisting it, finds something in her that is somewhat noble and even heroic, and finds the courage to share that with her kid, and in doing that, maybe repair something. I mean, it's all very ambivalent in coming to closure about that, but I love this idea that we are all often watching anti-heroes and anti-heroines try to find their humanity as opposed to continually deny or reject their humanity. That's a cool way of looking at it.
It also seems like a huge part of this story is about accountability and try to make amends even if you're not completely skilled enough to do that.
Yes, I think it's the lack of skill that makes this more relatable, and my hope for people is, or certainly to me, is that it's not always easy to be accountable. It's not easy to atone. I feel we're in this moment that we could easily look back at it as the sort of perilous tipping point where black was white and the sun is out, but it's raining, and there's a sense of no looking in the mirror and saying, this is what I see. And so for me, that frustration I feel with the larger culture and the larger political landscape, I think got worked out in telling a story about this one woman.
How important is it to have a creative partner who's also your life partner? And is that a blessing? Is it sometimes an issue? How would you describe it?
I mean, I am so lucky because I have a partner in life who is also a partner in film for me, in Phil Hay. And yet he also negotiates a relationship with more than just me in partnership. He negotiates a relationship with Matt Manfredi, who's been his partner for 25 years. And so in some ways, what we're all doing together is like being a family in a way and working on communicating effectively and kindly and with, you know, with purpose. Because I think it can, I think the hardest thing to do for many of us is really communicate ourselves in a way that keeps life moving forward in a positive direction. It's really easy to mess that up, really easy, with the people you love, especially, strangely enough. And so we have to practice it every day. In our work and in our life. And I mean, sometimes I'm annoyed that I have to practice, but in the same way that I'm annoyed that I have to exercise, I still have to do it. You know what I mean?
We're talking with Karin Kusama about her new film, Destroyer. We're on location in the LA River, and this is a place where the movie begins. And without saying anything else, we might come back to this location later in the story, but you're not on a soundstage. You're not on a studio lot. There are trains going by. They're dredging the river. There's helicopters. There's traffic. How do you shoot in as noisy a city as LA? There goes a dump truck going by. hauling dirt from the dredging operation. And, I mean, you can't tell them to stop cleaning out the river. What do you do?
I have to say, on a day-to-day level and on a technical level, it was the number one challenge of the whole movie, the sound. Because we were on location every single day. We were never not at a real location, shooting that location for what it was. And so part of it was finding a balance where we could stop and say, all right, this train is simply too loud. We won't hear any of the dialogue. Let's just stop, take a zen moment, listen to the train pass, which we had to do at this very location many times because the train tracks abut this part of the river. And then there were times where, particularly with things like helicopters, if we felt the helicopters sort of tailing in and tailing out, it actually was a great guide for when we were really building our sound design later, because it was just such a good reminder of this idea of a noisy city. I mean, it is so loud in most of Los Angeles, and we're just so used to it. We're so used to the sound of distant traffic that I think I would start to panic if I didn't hear it in the background, you know? So in some ways, it was the most difficult technical challenge of the movie, but then also the thing that created a lot of, I want to say, creative inspiration.
So in addition to shooting right here in the LA River, you have an amazing shot where somebody comes over a hill and they are on top of Dodger Stadium almost. So can you talk a little bit more about the locations you were looking for in LA and what was going on in the city around that time?
So in the script, there was always a scene that took place in a kind of hilly spit of LA hillside that looked out at Dodger Stadium on one side and downtown LA on the other. And none of us had actually been to this spot. But from the highway and from certain streets in Silver Lake and Echo Park, you had to imagine it existed. And Robert Foulkes found an abandoned park called Victory Grove Park. And we walked up through it, and there were abandoned guitars and used needles and doll heads. I mean, it was really like, you think this is grim. It was also pretty intense. And there in front of us was Dodger Stadium. And we turned around, and there behind us was downtown LA. And the sun was setting, and it was just like, I cannot believe we found this place. And I have to say, as we were prepping, we were in the playoffs, and I was able to get Dodger Stadium, every single car in the parking lot, filled into that parking lot, and see Dodger Stadium during a playoff game. And that was an amazing opportunity, because we didn't have to build it. We, you know, that wasn't CGI. That was just real. We just got to see Dodger Stadium packed to the gills, and also, you know, hear the game. And I feel like there was just so much, there were so many bicycling, like impromptu bicycling events where we would be shooting and out of nowhere, hundreds of bicyclists would go by. This happened in Chinatown once. And Nicole just stood there and just said, I just have to watch this. Like, it was so awe-inspiring. I don't know. I just feel like there was something very lively about the city while we were shooting in it. And I think there's something lively about the city every day.
Karin, great to see you.
Thank you so much. This was so fun to sit out on this, like, windy perch of the river. It's kind of a trippy place, isn't it?
Karin Kusama is the director of the movie Destroyer, which stars Nicole Kidman. It opens on Christmas Day. Coming up, CBS has donated some money that would have gone to Les Moonves to organizations trying to stop sexual harassment. We talk with one person tasked with putting those funds to work. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The board of CBS recently told its former leader, Les Moonves, that he would not get any of his potential $120 million severance. And that's because Moonves not only allegedly sexually assaulted and harassed multiple women while running the network, but also apparently lied to CBS investigators and tried to destroy evidence. Before Moonves lost his severance, CBS decided to donate $20 million to a variety of organizations. The largest recipient was the Producers Guild of America. The Hollywood Guild will use the money to fund a new program called the Independent Production Safety Initiative, and its goal is to provide free sexual harassment training and legal advice for independent film, TV, and digital productions. Lucy Fisher is the co-president of the PGA.
The studios now make approximately, sometimes more, sometimes less, only 200 movies a year. When I was vice chairman at Sony, we would make 25 or 30 movies a year, to just put it in perspective, whereas something like Sundance gets 12,000 submissions a year. So the independent movies are many, and they don't have the budgets to have a sexual harassment training person come to the set, then they don't have the budgets to have a legal department. So those movies were sort of without any sort of net to help them. And we realized that there was a gaping need for independent productions to have some access to training and some access to legal counsel. One might also say there might be a need even when productions at a studio or a network do have an HR department or a legal department, and some might question whether or not that department is really there to protect the victim or really there to protect the entity that pays them. But we're not dealing with that with this program. This program is for the people that are completely unprotected because they don't have the access.
When I look at the organizations that are getting money from CBS, they include organizations like Time's Up, Women in Film, the Women's Law Center. The Producers Guild is probably the only organization that I know of that has had sexual harassers and enablers in its midst, including Harvey Weinstein. So what is the Producers Guild doing internally to make sure that assets going onto film sets and doing this training, that its own house is in order? What specifically do you think the PGA needs to do, and what is it doing right now?
That's a good question. If you know something and you don't speak up, you are complicit. So if people know something about somebody, they do speak up now and say, you know, I've heard bad things about that person or whatever. So that is something that we're trying to do. Also, the PGA, as you probably know, is not a union. It's a voluntary guild. But we are looking at people certainly more closely. How do we find out? It's hard to say. You don't want to convict somebody on a word-of-mouth accusation that isn't a true one. One of the things that we're hoping that will happen is that at some point the commission will be able to be an adjudicating board, which it isn't yet. We don't have the wherewithal or the finances to do that, so that if somebody is accused, somebody can get to the bottom of it and say, that was a false accusation, or that was a very real accusation, and that's not a person who we want to be a member of the guild.
And what can the PGA do to address enablers? Of all of the parts of the Les Moonves story, I have to say one of the things that I find most disturbing is the behavior of former PGA member Arnold Copelson. Arnold Copelson died not that long ago, but he was Les's biggest defender. He did not report to the board a story that he knew to be true of Les Moonves allegedly assaulting his own physician. And when the New Yorker stories first came out, he said, quote, I don't care if 30 more women come forward and allege this kind of stuff. Les is our leader, and it wouldn't change my opinion of him. So what can the PGA, what can anybody do about enablers like Arnold Copelson who don't say anything and defend somebody who's accused of sexually assaulting a number of people?
It is as abhorrent as it can get to read that statement by him. I don't know the answer to that because we haven't gotten that far yet as to how we can treat enablers that are members. It's a wiggly road. I think that you're right that we do eventually want to, but we don't have a mechanism in place at the moment. You're touching on a very serious area that we agree needs to be addressed. We haven't had the time or the wherewithal to do that yet.
Let me ask you this last question. You've been in the business for a good time. You've had great jobs, great credits. What is it like as a woman in Hollywood, or just as a veteran producer and executive, to see story after story, Harvey Weinstein, Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer, Les Moonves, James Toback, Brett Ratner? What is it like to be in the business and see these stories keep repeating themselves week after week, month after month, year after year?
Nauseating. You feel filthy and you feel furious and you feel frustrated. How do I feel? I feel like I wanted to do something. It's why I became the president of the Guild with Gail Berman. We felt the same way. We felt that this was a moment in time where we could possibly use the 8,500 members that we have in order to have a power base that was bigger to try to make a statement and to try to do something about this. I think bringing people like Arnold Copelson to task, dead or alive, and I feel bad that saying it because he's dead, but I think that the more people understand that there will be consequences and they won't be welcome in people's homes and they won't be welcome at a restaurant and they won't be re-embraced as one of the guys and, you know, aren't we just having fun and aren't the women being annoying and they can't take a joke, the less that that happens and the more that people say the norm is to not act that way and that's not acceptable behavior. And I hope that we can talk again and say that things are better. Do I know for sure? No. All I know is that we can take our baby steps one step at a time. We'll learn from that.
Lucy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
And that's all that we have for this week. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. See you back here on Monday.